from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, former presidents take on Donald Trump. White House Chief of Staff John Kelly defends the condolence calls, health care battles, Kirkuk, Raqqa, and a Me Too movement. Here was former President George W. Bush in New York yesterday with his rebuke of a president not named, but clearly in mind.
Bullying and prejudice in our public life sets a national tone, provides permission for cruelty and bigotry, and compromises the moral education of children. The only way to pass along civic values is to first live up to them.
White House Chief of Staff John Kelly gave a passionate defense of the president's military condolence calls and went after a congresswoman who was there for one.
There's no perfect way to make that phone call. It stuns me that a member of Congress would have listened in on that conversation.
And countless women came forward to share their stories of sexual harassment and assault as the hashtag MeToo goes viral.
Me too. And I was blamed for it. I was told not to talk about it.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Nancy Cordes of CBS News, Michael Crowley of Politico, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you think of President Trump's two immediate predecessors criticizing the current occupant of the Oval Office? And was General Kelly right to defend him on the condolence call? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington, Nancy Cordes, Chief Congressional Correspondent for CBS News. Nancy, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you with us today.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Also from Washington, Michael Crowley joins us, Senior Foreign Affairs Correspondent for Politico. Michael, welcome back.
Hi, Tom. Very glad to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Nancy, and Michael.
Can we dive right into this criticism, without naming the president, but very clearly targeted at the president by two just immediate past presidents, George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Here are some highlights from the speech that George Bush gave just yesterday in New York.
We've seen our discourse degraded by casual cruelty. At times it can seem like the forces pulling us apart are stronger than the forces binding us together. Argument turns too easily into animosity.
We have seen discourse degraded by casual cruelty, said George W. Bush, and this on bigotry.
Bigotry seems emboldened. Our politics seems more vulnerable to conspiracy theories and outright fabrication.
And this on bigotry, race, white supremacy.
People of every race, religion, ethnicity can be fully and equally American. It means that bigotry or white supremacy in any form is blasphemy against the American creed.
President Bush had more to say, and we'll hear it. President Obama on the campaign trail as well. Here he was at a campaign in for New Jersey gubernatorial candidate Phil Murphy yesterday as well.
What we can't have is the same old politics of division that we have seen so many times before, that dates back centuries. Some of the politics we see now, we thought we put that to bed. I mean, that's folks looking 50 years back. It's the 21st century, not the 19th century.
Barack Obama and George W. Bush bringing it right back to those charged now with preserving and protecting democracy. Here he was.
We know that when we lose sight of our ideals, it is not democracy that has failed. It is the failure of those charged with preserving and protecting democracy.
Nancy Cordes in Washington. Holy smokes, that was a double barrel a rebuke without naming President Trump, but very clearly aimed at President Trump from two former sitting presidents. Can you recall any precedent for this, Nancy?
No. And let's not forget that beyond the two of them, you had Vice President Biden this week who did name names and said very clearly in a 7-minute long rebuke of President Trump that he doesn't know anything, that he doesn't understand government, that he doesn't understand societal norms, and the norms that he does understand, he's actively trying to destroy, that he is making people afraid of a nuclear war, that world leaders are reaching out to Biden wanting to know what is going on with the United States. So these are three very powerful former figureheads here in the United States who have been really keeping their mouths shut for 9 months now out of a sense of protocol and tradition that you, once you've been in the White House, been in the Oval Office, you give the newcomers the benefit of the doubt, let them get their sea legs. But Vice President Biden said he did that and he's done because he doesn't believe that President Trump has the nation's best interests at heart. It was really an astounding tirade.
And those that not all. We had Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona here at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia on Monday.
To refuse the obligations of international leadership and our duty to remain the last best hope of Earth for the sake of some half-baked, spurious nationalism cooked up by people who would rather find scapegoats than solve problems.
John McCain just scathing there, half-baked, spurious nationalism. Michael Crowley, how do these strike your ear? And what does it mean that we have former presidents, former vice president, Republican former president George W. Bush, Republican Senator John McCain? I mean, we know Donald Trump is not a typical Republican, but this is quite a broadside in 1 week.
It really is. It's sort of a pileup, and that grabs your attention. The simultaneity in particular of Bush and Obama, I have no reason to think that that was scheduled. They were speaking in very different places, but kind of has an exponential impact when you combine them. And then, of course, you throw in McCain and Biden. It is extraordinary. Much of what we heard is not particularly new or different, and neither from what we've been hearing sort of in commentary throughout the country since Trump was inaugurated, nor even during the campaign, when a great many Democrats and Republicans were sort of pleading with the electorate not to vote for Trump. But I do think, particularly in the case of Bush and Obama yesterday, the way in which two former presidents were sort of going in unison against a sitting president really has the feeling of something that we've not seen before in our lifetimes. And although the arguments themselves, while very eloquent, I think didn't break any new ground for anyone who's been following our national debate in the past 10 or so months or longer, it's a barometer of the fact that, Trump is still way outside the mainstream, the political mainstream in this country. He's been president of the United States for 10 months now, and the host is still kind of trying to reject the parasite, if you will, at least from the perspective of his critics. And in some ways, people worry that Trump is normalizing, that his outrageous and unprecedented behavior has become so commonplace and such a daily occurrence that we're becoming inured to it. And I think that what these people are doing, Bush, Obama, Biden, McCain, is trying to step back and remind people that this is not normal. Don't get too used to it. This is not how it should be. And to reassert fundamental first principles with their uniquely powerful megaphones. So really, it is extraordinary.
Some who would reject, some who would embrace. Jack Beatty, even coming from past sitting presidents or past presidents, does it matter now? Or has the country somehow have our politics broken with the past, with this legacy that they're appealing to the nation to sustain?
I think they're calling on a legacy that seems dormant to revive, and trying to revive it. And they're putting it in very similar terms. FDR once said, "Everything a president does teaches." And both presidents, Obama and Bush, laid stress on that. We quoted President Bush talking about the example of bullying, quote, compromising the moral education of children. President Obama speaking in Virginia yesterday said, if you want those values of American decency, fairness, pluralism, and so on, if you want those values that you're teaching your children reinforced, then you've got to vote. Talking about voting, young people voting in a gubernatorial election. This idea, what is it the lesson that Mr. Trump is passing on? What can people, you know, parents say to children about what Trump stands for? Lying with impunity? A president who's caught on tape bragging about sexually molesting women, still elected president, taking no responsibility for anything. He said this week, I'm not going to take any blame for this. All of these are the opposite of what every parent tries to teach children. And I think the former presidents are saying that the example of Trump has to be resisted almost at the level of the family.
Nancy Cordes, Republicans might say, well, all right, when it's Barack Obama. What about when it's George W. Bush? It's been a while since he was president now, but what are you hearing from Republicans on Capitol Hill about a former Republican president rebuking the sitting president so sternly?
Well, look, these are not things that they haven't heard before or that they haven't discussed among themselves or privately, even with reporters, even though publicly, for the most part, Republican leaders still try to avoid criticizing the president whenever they can. I mean, you had the Senate's majority leader, Mitch McConnell, standing there right next to him in the Rose Garden this week when the president made several patently false claims, including the fact that former presidents didn't call the families of fallen soldiers.
The assertion that they did. Not a fact, I guess.
No, not a fact. And it created instant fury among aides to President Obama and others who said, why would he ever say something like that? And wasn't rebuked by Leader McConnell. So publicly, at least Republicans who are in office and planning to stay in office still feel like they need to keep quiet.
This podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Looking for your next great hire, but short on time? You just need the right tools, smarter tools. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 top job boards with just one click. Then their smart technology notifies the most qualified candidates to apply. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. Right now, you can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/OP. That's ZipRecruiter.com/OP. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Former presidents take on Donald Trump. General Kelly defends him on the condolence call. Healthcare battles, the way cleared for a tax vote. Kirkuk, Raqqa, we'll look at those. The drugs are scandal, and Me Too has gone viral. Nancy Cordes is with us, chief congressional correspondent for CBS News. Michael Crowley is here, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. What did you make of Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama coming out yesterday with tough critiques of what's going on right now with the White House? And what about General Kelly's defense of the president on that condolence call? Beyond that, is Trump right? Is Obamacare dead, dying? Is he killing it? The words from those presidents still resonating today. Here's just a little bit more from George Bush talking about nationalism and nativism, talking about the kind of planks of American policy at home and abroad that he pursued now being abandoned. Here's Bush.
We've seen nationalism distorted into nativism. We've forgotten the dynamism that immigration has always brought to America. We see a fading confidence in the value of free markets and international trade, forgetting that conflict, instability, and poverty follow in the wake of protectionism.
George Bush with his critique of the Trump way. John in Detroit, thanks for calling, John. You're on the air.
So at first I found this all very intriguing, listening to all the shows and watching Trevor Noah and the other late night
comedy go off on
it. I think that somebody has to get real about it. We can't just be keep pointing out what is. We have to figure out how to gather the sane, normal, rational people to call to action to do something about this, because this is becoming a big diversion from all that is coming to a head.
Is it a big diversion, Nancy, or is it at the heart of things? Does this matter, or somehow is the parade moved on and former presidents can make this kind of sweeping, practically condemnation, and it doesn't land? I mean, after all, Trump ran against George Bush's brother, was kind of humiliated by him in the primaries. Maybe people just say this is just sour grapes in the past.
I certainly agree with your caller that if people did mobilize and rise up, that could have an impact. And it's certainly clear that Republican lawmakers are still concerned about the large portion of their base who are President Trump's base. And they are afraid of alienating those voters. And therefore, they, they tend to keep quiet when they can because, they've seen what has happened to some of their Republican colleagues who have spoken up. And they've seen those colleagues be threatened with a primary challenger by Steve Bannon. They've gotten the hate emails and the hate tweets. And it's an uncomfortable position to be in. So if and until it's just as uncomfortable to say nothing, that is going to be the default for a lot of lawmakers on Capitol Hill.
What a situation. Ali in Lexington, Massachusetts, shot fired, heard around the world. Ali, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My comment is that this criticism from the former president and McCain and other officials, it's not going to make any difference whatsoever, because the core supporters of Trump, they're not going to change their mind based on these criticisms. And you can just check that if you go on the alt-right website, on Breitbart and whatnot, and look at the comments. The more criticism Trump faces from these folks, the more his supporters go for him.
So should the former presidents be quiet, Ali?
No, they shouldn't be. They should continue to criticize him. But the country is so divided, so fragmented, that it's not going to make a difference in Trump's attitude, because he's just appealing to his core supporters.
Riding
what he goes for.
Yep, riding a different wave, and it is there, but then this is quite remarkable as well. Ali, I appreciate your call. Waterford, Pennsylvania. Dolores, you're on.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make 2 points regarding yesterday's events. Well, while President Obama was in office, we didn't hear a peep from President Bush. So I think what happened yesterday was truly unprecedented. But I think the speeches by these two former presidents show us that the current administration and its supporters, i.e. Bannon and Spencer, are really taking us to a dark place. And this is really deeply concerning. And also regarding General Kelly, if he would have been serving under a normal president, he would not have had to make that speech yesterday, which I am sure was very painful for him. But unfortunately, he is the chief of staff for someone who suffers from malignant narcissism. And those are my comments. Thank you.
Dolores, thanks for calling. Jack, what does the country do at the moment like this? I mean, Nancy's there on Capitol Hill, and, she's saying people there, Republicans, have their heads down. Outside, you've got two presidents. George W., much more forthrightly and fiercely, I would say, than Obama yesterday, going hammer and tongs at this president. Do we just nod and keep walking?
Well, there are going to be consequences. Political scientists have pointed out for years that what gives, what can really hurt a political figure is bipartisan criticism. That bipartisan criticism is taken much more seriously than something a President Obama would say, or a Biden. And so Republicans who are affected by the memory of Bush-era Republicanism and 20th century Republicanism will be affected by what the president said. And there's also a reaction on the other side to Trumpism, and that is you can see it in the polls, the generic congressional ballot. Who would you vote for, Republican or Democrat, if the election were held today? The generic congressional ballot now has Democrats up by as much as 16 points. That portends, and of course a lot can happen between now and the election next year, but that portends a Democratic wave. So something could happen on the Republican side, losing people, some people who are affected by what the a legitimate criticism from the former president and others, and on the Democratic side, the resistance getting to the polls.
Well, we'll see. And then there was General John Kelly's remarkable appearance yesterday in the White House. Passionate words from a man who doesn't often speak up and speak up in this way, not in that setting, in defense of his president. He's chief of staff to Donald Trump now, of course, and how he handled a condolence call that came to the center of national attention for a while this week. This is for one of the four servicemen who died in Niger earlier this week, LaDavid Johnson, and a call that had gone from the president to his widow, pregnant widow, it turns out. There were others. It was in the car. There were others in that car. It was on the speaker. Others heard it. Here was John Kelly yesterday saying that he had first advised President Trump when he came to the White House not to call relatives of service members who were killed in action.
When I took this job and talked to President Trump about how to do it, my first recommendation was he not do it. Because it's not the phone call that parents, family members are looking forward to.
But the president had said earlier in the week that this is something he does. He compared himself favorably to past presidents who he incorrectly, falsely asserted had not made calls. Of course, they had done calls and letters. There's a mix. But then came this call and the depiction of it as poorly received by those in that car. And then here, John Kelly yesterday.
I was stunned when I came to work yesterday morning and brokenhearted at what I saw a member of Congress doing. A member of Congress who listened in on a phone call from the President of the United States to a young wife, and in his way tried to express that opinion. He's a brave man, a fallen hero. He knew what he was getting himself into because he enlisted.
And here was the Congresswoman, Frederica Williams, Wilson, of Florida, who had been in the car with Maisha Johnson as they traveled to meet the body of LaDavid T. Johnson, who had been killed in Niger, talking with MSNBC's Morning Joe on Wednesday about what she'd heard the president tell Maisha.
Something to the fact that he knew what he was getting into when he signed up, but I guess it hurts anyway. You know, just matter-of-factly. That this is what happens. Anyone who is signing up for military duty is signing up to die.
Michael Crowley, you cover national security, foreign affairs. Step back here. What are we in the midst of? I mean, there were four lives lost. That's a terrible cost to the country and to those families. The president reached out in this phone call, and then the description of it, you know, the first word that came out painted him as callous or just not appropriately plugged into the pain of the family. But John Kelly, who, of course, General Kelly, who lost his own son in Afghanistan in 2010, coming to the president's passionate defense yesterday. Of course, he worked for the president, with the president. What do you see here, Michael?
Well, Tom, in some ways I see this as an iteration of the ongoing culture wars that are shaping Donald Trump's presidency and the debate around Trump. And I say that as a matter of political analysis. Obviously, what matters most here is the loss of U.S. life, U.S. troops who were performing counterterror operations in Africa. And we can talk about why that's happening and the circumstances which are still being investigated of this tragic ambush, it appears to have been, by terrorist fighters. But the way this is resonating in the public debate right now, you know, does seem to be another one of these battles about kind of who the good guys and bad guys are as perceived by these dueling political camps. And Trump was initially very much on the defensive, in part because he made this sort of inaccurate swipe at Barack Obama, suggesting that Obama didn't call troops, and the implication was that Obama had been cavalier about the loss of—
And not only Obama. American he life. Sort of painted a broader brush than that, going back through previous presidents, but yes.
Right. And, you know, this is what infuriates a lot of Trump's critics, that he was so glib about and wrong about such an incredibly grave matter, and particularly to speak that way as someone who has in the past leveled shocking criticisms of U.S. service members. I mean, I still to this day, Tom, I don't understand how Donald Trump survived criticizing John McCain for being captured in Vietnam. We can come back to that. But, you know, that kind of set the tone for everything about Trump at the beginning of this at the beginning of his campaign. He said that in mid-2015, said, "I like the ones who don't get captured," and questioned the idea that McCain was a hero. But, you know, Kelly now comes forward as sort of, you know, close to the ultimate validator. I mean, oh, and by the way, Donald Trump is a guy who didn't serve in Vietnam, had, I think, some bone fragments
five
in his foot.
Yep.
Relatively minor condition, although a lot of people, you know, had similar situations. Yep. But John Kelly comes forward, ultimate validator, a Marine general who lost his son in Vietnam in 2010. And now Trump is in essentially in a battle with, I don't think it's irrelevant to say, a black female congresswoman. There is yet again in one of these fights Donald Trump has an element of race. It may be totally accidental, but I think it's already, I'm watching the way both sides are reacting to this, shaping the conversation and the coverage, and it's becoming another fight in the culture wars. And I'll just close the, or mm-hmm. you know, finish the thought by adding the way that Kelly talked about this was very much, you know, all these things in America that used to be sacrosanct no longer are. And he ticked off this list, including there were some curious entries. One of them was women. He said women used to be sacrosanct and they are no longer. I'm not sure exactly what he meant. But his point was calls with grieving widows from a president used to be sacrosanct and now they're being hashed out in public. It was kind of a yearning for an America that's been lost. He also seemed to be criticizing the press corps for not having enough connection to, you know, the military established in the United States.
But this came on a day when you had former presidents saying Donald Trump has helped jettison some of those, the sacred quality of, I mean, around women with the comments that were there. It's not as if President Trump has been a standard bearer necessarily in everyone's eyes for those.
Of course not, Tom. That was not my point at all, mm-hmm. but that we are further dividing into these camps. What are the sacred things in this country? What are the ones that have to be preserved? Which ones have been lost? Whose fault is it? And every argument seems to be kind of coming back. I mean, several weeks ago, we were having an argument about, you know, the heritage of white men in America. It just seems like constant iterations of that same argument. And I'll stop with this point. I don't want to minimize the underlying substance of the loss of life, which is most important here. But I do think this political debate is shaping the identity of our country. So we have to analyze it.
I mean, Nancy, there was also the interesting point that General Kelly said, well, he repeated the words that for his own son and knew what he was signing up for, as if to validate that statement by the president. But the president, Nancy, had denied that he said that to the widow in Florida.
Right. And while Kelly criticized Congresswoman Wilson for listening in on the call, he did not dispute her recollection of what happened. And in fact, he said something to the effect of, you know, he comforted this widow the best way he could, basically giving a nod to the fact that this is perhaps not President Trump's greatest strength, but it's the fact that he tried that matters. But let's not forget that the whole reason that this blew up in the first place was because 16 days ago, when this tragedy took place in Niger, mm-hmm. You know, reporters, the public waited to hear from the president about A, what had happened, B, you know, some words to the country, some kind of condolence about what had happened to these four men, a tweet. There was nothing. There was silence. Reporters were asking the White House, why haven't we heard from the president about this? And they really didn't have an answer. And it wasn't until Monday, when he was giving a press conference in the Rose Garden, that he was asked by a reporter, why haven't we heard from you about these four U.S. service members who were killed in Niger? And that's when he started talking about the fact that he was going to call the families. He hadn't called them yet. He wanted to give them some time. And by the way, his predecessors, he doesn't think they, that's what he's heard, is that they never called the families. No one had pressed him on whether he had called the families. No one had pressed him on whether he wasn't doing enough to console these families and he was falling behind his predecessors. These are all things he brought up himself. He was simply asked, why haven't we heard from you about this incident?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, protesters drowned out white supremacist leader Richard Spencer in Florida yesterday. Here's CBS News' Hannah Doba.
Protesters took over the speech by white nationalist Richard Spencer, many cursing at him, holding their fist in the air and chanting.
In Beijing, China's President Xi Jinping urged high ambition and flexibility as that country's once every five-year Congress opened Wednesday.
All party comrades must set their sights far and high and think of danger in times of safety, be willing to change and innovate, be willing not to become stiff or stop.
The news from China, and the Los Angeles Dodgers are on the way to the World Series after besting the defending champs, the Chicago Cubs. Dodgers outfielder Enrique Hernandez had three home runs, including a grand slam in the deciding game of the National League Championship Series. Here he is celebrating in the locker room with his teammates.
I don't remember last time the Dodgers got to the World Series because I wasn't even born yet, but we're in the World Series.
Right.
Yeah. And guess what? We got four games to go this week.
There go the Dodgers. We're looking at a week in the news with Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, Nancy Cordes, chief congressional correspondent for CBS News, and Jack Beatty is with us as well, On Point news analyst with us today from Hanover, New Hampshire. You can join us. What do you see in this week on healthcare, abroad, on the fall of Raqqa, on Kurds and Baghdad, U.S. allies fighting over Kirkuk? Did you watch the fall of Trump's drug czar pick? What do you make of that? And Trump, Donald, the president, gives himself a 10 on Puerto Rico relief. Would you? And what do you make of the millions saying, me too, this week? Paul's calling from Detroit, Michigan. Paul, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling in regard to the condolence calls, and your panel has covered it pretty thoroughly. But we are literally in a he said, she said moment here. And while my heart goes out to General Kelly as a Gold Star parent himself, having lost a child in Iraq, I think at this point the president and, unfortunately, his administration in general no longer deserve the benefit of the doubt from the people of the nation. There have been so many instances of untruths, falsehoods, outright lies, completely unnecessary, gratuitously cruel comments from this man that I, for one, unfortunately, don't even trust what General Kelly is saying. And he's clearly saying it very reluctantly. I feel so sorry for him, but that's the position he's in, serving a man who really does not deserve our confidence any longer.
Well, I don't know if he wanted to come forward, but he didn't seem to be he seemed forthright in what he was saying yesterday. At least it was passionate, that certainly. Paul, in Detroit there, may I read you a comment from a listener with a different view here? This is a comment on our website from handle is Jonathan Boston, and he says this, Paul. One of the reasons Trump was elected was because so many people were fed up with political correctness and the inability of politicians to speak plainly and honestly to the American people. The net result is escalating decline of this country. Trump is not that well-spoken and has his character flaws, but to have questioned his sincerity and sensitivity to the grieving widow was disgusting. But you get the gist there, Paul. Here's a listener saying, come on, we wanted something different, not what George W. Bush and Barack Obama were delivering.
Well, that may be, but I think in this particular case, Trump has stepped far across the line of political correctness, once again, as I say, into just sort of unnecessary, gratuitous, and cruel comments. Yes, he's a poorly spoken individual. I don't think he organizes his thoughts well. He shoots and speaks from the hip. But that's not what we look for, nor frankly deserve, from the President of the United States.
Paul in Detroit, we've got it, and I appreciate your call very much. I want to get to more, if I may. Thank you, Paul. James in Atlanta, Georgia. James, you're on. Hello, James.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, you're on, James.
I just wanted to say that
by pure happenstance, I met with my congressman yesterday and had a half-hour conversation. He's a Republican. I'm a registered Republican, although I vote as an independent, of course. And my concern was the relationship of Congress to the presidency as it stands at this moment. And I find it very frightening. And he spent a half hour, instead of dealing with anything that I was talking about, trying to convince me that Donald Trump's a completely normal guy and everything is great, and we're getting a lot done up here. If our other congressmen have their head in the sand as much as he does, we have a real problem in Washington that goes far more endemically deeper than simply a frankly dangerously imbalanced president.
James, I'm going to take it right there, if I may, and I appreciate your call. I mean, we've got all kinds of views here, and we're hearing them, but warnings from former presidents yesterday, or critique anyway. Jack Beatty, what about on the General Kelly, Donald Trump front, and the kind of unease the country is feeling here? Maybe different kinds of unease, but certainly unease.
Yes, and about something that has never before been the focus of any kind of controversy, that the president uniquely introduced this point of difference with his gratuitous swipe at past presidents. But, you know, Tom, this has a wider context. What happened to those soldiers and why? Reporting in Reuters, the AP, the Times, MSNBC is drawing a picture, and the picture is this. That in September, the Trump administration announced, put Chad on its list of countries under the travel ban.
Yep, neighbor of Niger, right next door.
Experts at the time couldn't believe it. Africa hands said, "What are you doing? Chad sends troops, very skillful troops, to all sorts of surrounding countries anytime there's a terrorist problem to put it down. We have a base in Chad." The Chadian government couldn't understand it. And a State Department person at the time said, "This could cost American lives because Chad will react." Chad did react. It withdrew its troops from Niger. And some short time after that, these men were killed. These four Americans were killed on a patrol that they had taken 29 times or so in the past. Is this part of what Trump is trying to cover up, that there was this huge blunder in assigning Chad? And why did it happen? Well, according to the AP, it may be because, for a bureaucratic reason, that Chad had run out of passport paper and the Department of Homeland Security was demanding every country that was at all suspect to send copies of their passports. And Chad couldn't get it in on time, and Department of Homeland Security said, "You're on the list." That's a kind of bureaucratic snafu. Did that have anything to do with the vulnerability of these soldiers? And are we all talking about the horrible issues of, you know, the trauma of these widows and so on, when really behind it all there's this cover up for a bad, bad decision?
That I don't know about. I want to turn, if I may, because a lot of other things happened this week. Among them, an effort on Capitol Hill. I'll come to you, Nancy, on this bipartisan effort to try and find a way of keeping Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, and its provision, its coverage from just skittering right off the table. It sort of began with the president on Tuesday sharply criticizing the Affordable Care Act a few days after he announced that he would terminate subsidies to ease the cost of health care premiums and saying it's virtually dead. Here he was.
Obamacare is virtually dead. At best, you could say it's in its final legs. The premiums are going through the roof. The deductibles are so high that people don't get to use it. Obamacare is a disgrace to our nation, and we are solving the problem of Obamacare.
Well, on Capitol Hill, there were Republicans and Democrats, at least two, who were trying to find a bipartisan solution to this. Here was Republican Senator Lamar Alexander, Republican from Tennessee, of course. He and Senator Patty Murray, Democrat out of Washington, have reached an agreement this week to fund the subsidies for health insurers under the Affordable Care Act for the next 2 years, something that President Trump had worked to end just a few days earlier. Here's Senator Murray speaking with reporters about this bipartisan deal.
Chairman Alexander and I were able to find common ground on a number of steps to stabilize the markets and to help protect families from premium spikes as a result of the sabotage we have seen from this administration.
And here's the Republican, Lamar Alexander, Senator, on the same front.
This agreement avoids chaos. And I don't know a Democrat or a Republican who benefits from chaos.
Nancy Cordes, the president seemed to go hot and cold on this in the course of the week. At week's end, do we have something here that would keep this program going? Or is the president right? The Affordable Care Act, Obamacare is virtually dead?
It's not virtually dead. There are still millions of people who rely on coverage provided via the individual marketplace, and millions of them rely on premium support from the federal government. So it's still very much alive, although Democrats would concede imperfect, and that's why you need this bipartisan deal in the first place. The deal is still alive as well, although it certainly took some hits this week when the president seemed to support it and then oppose it, and then he doesn't know, and then he opposes it again. And what the White House is now saying is that in order for it to win his support, it has to not just stabilize the individual markets for 2 years with this big infusion of cash that is called for in the Affordable Care Act to help insurance companies bring down deductibles and copays, but you've also got to do something that basically makes Obamacare less like Obamacare. So they'd like to see either the individual mandate rolled back or requirements for employers to provide health coverage rolled back, things that Democrats are going to be incredibly reluctant to sign on to. So this is still a work in progress, because the big challenge for Republicans is they don't want to pull the rug out from under people who rely on their coverage on the individual market. They don't want suddenly millions of people to either lose coverage if their insurance companies pull out or see their premiums spike. But they also don't want to do something that could be viewed as propping up Obamacare, a law that they have been vowing to repeal for 7 years.
Nancy, may we turn to another front, changes to the tax code. Republicans pushed the Senate budget resolution through yesterday, $4 trillion budget. It will let them go at changes to the tax law with just, I guess, just a simple majority instead of facing a filibuster. We had the Dow at 23,000 this week, and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin on a political broadcast Tuesday saying that failure to pass the proposed Republican tax changes could have serious consequences for the stock market. Here he was.
I think to the extent we get the tax deal done, the stock market will go up higher. But there's no question in my mind, if we don't get it done, you're going to see a reversal of a significant amount of these gains.
It sounds like the market has held hostage here. What are the prospects for the changes that I know many are not detailed yet, Nancy, but for the kind of changes Republicans have in mind?
Well, they certainly took a very important step by passing this budget in the Senate, which was not always assured. You needed virtually every Republican to hang together, and they did. And what that budget does is it sets the table for tax reform. It basically creates a $1.5 trillion allotment for a tax reform bill to be passed later. It's still being written. And that enables Republicans, once they do finish crafting it, to try to pass it with a simple majority in the Senate. Very important, because the chances of getting Democratic support are pretty unlikely, especially if the bill resembles the outline that Republicans have put out, which a lot of independent analysts have determined would be a big boon to the wealthy, to corporations, but have a pretty middling effect on the middle class and working class taxpayers, especially because a lot of the things that Republicans are insisting will create tremendous growth and boost wages, you know, slashing the corporate tax rate almost in half, eliminating the estate tax, really haven't been proven to have much effect on wages, for example, in the past. So, you know, it's really an open question right now, Tom, because we just haven't seen the final bill yet, and we don't know what it's going to say and what Republicans are going to be able to agree on internally.
Yeah, I've got to take it abroad here. Michael Crowley, we don't have much time, but Kirkuk and Raqqa, U.S. allies, the Kurds and the U.S.-backed government in Baghdad fighting over Kirkuk, this oil-rich part of Iraq. And then in Syria, the fall of ISIS control of Raqqa, their putative capital. In brief, Michael, what do you make of these two?
I would say, Tom, it's one step forward and one step back in Iraq. The fall of Raqqa is a major symbolic, at a minimum, blow for ISIS. It is certainly a strategic blow, but not a death blow for ISIS, unfortunately. It's wonderful to see this demented caliphate collapsing, but ISIS fighters will likely carry on an insurgency in Iraq and Syria that can be very effective and very lethal, and continue to stage terror operations in Europe and the United States. So that's good news. Bad news, possible war between the Iraqi Arabs and Kurds after a September Kurdish referendum in which Kurds declared their independence from Iraq. The United States opposes Kurdish independence, as do Iran and Turkey. Iraqi government forces moved to take back key territory and, more importantly, lucrative oil fields from the Kurds in northern Iraq. And by the way, with Iranian assistance, which is a troublesome development. And it's not clear what happens next, but there's concern about a possible civil war in Iraq, which would be great news for ISIS, which thrives on chaos. So step forward and step back, and we will have to see how it plays out.
Nancy Cordes, just a thought. I wish we had more time, but we gave it a whole hour this week. The Me Too movement that swelled so much this week. Is it significant, Nancy? All these women coming forward and saying, you know what, that happened to me too, that harassment, that assault.
I think it's incredibly significant, and me too, by the way. I think that, you know, the more support that women feel in telling their stories publicly, the more courageous, the more supported they'll feel to actually go to their employers when this actually happens and inform people about what's happened to them and possibly prevent it from happening to someone else. But I think we've got a long way to go. I have a lot of friends who are still afraid to share what has happened to them because they're worried about what it will mean for their reputation, for their employment, and, you know, that's a very sad state of affairs.
Me Too echoing across the country this week. Nancy Cordes with CBS News. Thank you so much. Michael Crowley at Politico and Jack Beattie. Thanks to you all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.